Before we begin this episode, I want to give a shout out to somebody who's been providing us with some fantastic music. Many of you have emailed me even to tell me how much you really like the music. And much of it is provided to us by a former student of mine, Isaac Costin, who goes by The California Dropout. You can follow him. You can even purchase some of his music at Instagram at The California Dropout. Thanks, Isaac.
This is the Biblical Mind Podcast, produced by the Center for Hebraic Thought. Honest 5-star reviews help others find this podcast. Visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org for articles and videos that explore the deep structures of Scripture.
Mostly as a political philosopher, I'm interested in relationships of authority and how they can be properly established if they can. And it just seemed natural to me to focus a little bit on divine authority because, even if people in the academy don't really take claims of divine authority very seriously, many, many other people do. And so, many people do think that moral and political obligations are tied to divine commands. Yeah. These people think that people should do certain things and not do certain things, mainly because, or maybe solely because, God says so. So that's a relationship of authority. And, it might seem like an odd question to say, well, why does God get to have authority over us? Because maybe God just has natural authority over people. But I don't know. I'm not sure we should just assume that. I mean, after all, people aren't babies or slaves. Like, we take ourselves to be free people. No one just has an ordinary life. Just has the authority to tell us what we have to do. And we get right. asked the question, well, where do they get off? What gives them the right or the authority to tell us to do certain things?
Which, interestingly, in the biblical narratives, you get a very similar sentiment. Like, okay, what makes you Yahweh? Why should we listen to you, right? I mean, this is how
Good.
Moses reacts to him, right?
That's right.
Among other people.
That's right.
Yeah. I often tell my class, if you think the Bible is just about God commanding and us doing, he says jump, we say how high. Well, we're going to read a bunch of stories here where that's not how it goes at all. So the question then can become, well, what is the proper reaction to God? So,
that's right. So in this class I was teaching, it was sort of a comparison class between answers to this question in the scriptures and answers to this question in early modern political philosophy. And I guess the idea going in was that there's going to be more that these two periods, these two ways of answering this question, more similarities between them than you might have thought. So, in our Constitution, it says, we the people ordain and establish, this legal document, this authoritative structure for how we're going to organize our social life together. So in the early modern period, there was this notion of a social contract.
To interrupt real quickly, by early modern, you're talking about European philosophers, 17th, 18th century, who are discussing basically who gets off to tell somebody else what to do, right? How does that get negotiated out?
Exactly, right. So,
and this had a direct influence on all European law, but especially the construction of American thinking about law and Constitution.
Yes. Yeah, precisely. basically their answer was that we agree to do something, and that's the thing that establishes the authority to pass these laws and tell us how we're going to organize our lives together. So, I mean, this is a natural sort of thought, because we know in our ordinary lives that when we consent or agree to do something, we can make something that right up to that very moment was like optional, whether we do it or not. And it turns it into something that is like an obligation. Before I agreed to do this podcast, at this very time, it was optional whether I would talk to you, Drew, or listen to a Mastodon album. But as soon as I say, no, sure, I'll sign up and meet with you and talk to you for a while, it became wrong to listen to the Mastodon album at this time, and obligatory to talk to you. And so I think our political obligations are like that too. And I think you see something like that in the Hebrew scriptures with the covenantal structure of their social organization.
Yeah, let's explore that a little bit more, because I think for most people, again, that would not be... As a Bible scholar, it's obvious to me what you're saying.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people skip over the duh here. Yeah. So how is it that the people of Israel give their political consent to be ruled or to construct a government, or however you want to say it? Where is that? Where are you drawing this idea from?
So this would be the covenant that basically established the Hebrew folks as a people, as a nation. And you see it at the Sinai covenant in Exodus 19. So what you see there is basically a summary presentation of a kind of contract, a covenant. Mm-hmm. And God says, like, if you obey me and keep my covenant, you'll be my treasured possession. I'll extend certain benefits to you. But you have to keep the agreement. And then it says that Moses summoned the people, told them all the words that God had told them to speak, and they responded together. We will do everything the Lord has said. And it's sort of just like we the people
right.
ordain this agreement. Establish it. And so if this is a real agreement, then up until that moment where they said that they would do it, it was not the case that all the rules of the covenant applied to these people. And it's not the case that if they had said no, that they would have applied anyway, if it's a real agreement. I think it's presented as a real agreement.
And in that storyline too, I mean, if we could think about it, could have been otherwise. Like, so the story of Exodus and the Sinai covenant could have been God brought them to the mountain, and there he made a covenant with them, and he gave them his laws and instructions, and they, you know, floundered, and the story goes on from there. But there is this kind of on the ground from a eyewitness perspective account of it was laid out and they agreed. And even though we know their agreement is actually problematic because they don't actually carry out the laws. And they say things later in Joshua, like, just as we obeyed Moses,
yeah,
we will obey you. And anybody who's been reading up to that point should snicker a little bit. We want better than that. Right.
That's right.
But again, it's the gathering of the people, laying out what's expected, what can happen, the possibility of the relationship, and then seeking agreement, which is remarkable, right?
Yeah.
Even in ancient treaties, it's remarkable.
Yeah, I think that's right. You might have thought that, you know, God is just the kind of person who is to be obeyed. And here you might just introduce a kind of distinction. Surely, given the qualities that a divine being has, given the characteristics of the God, surely you have really good reason to obey him. But again, if you take the narrative seriously, then despite the fact that these people had like overwhelming reason to agree,
right,
the agreement didn't apply until and unless they did. So the distinction is between, right, reasons to sign up and whether or not those reasons to sign up are also reasons to hold them accountable, even if they don't sign up.
I'm interested in how you got into this track of thinking, because I thought that I had thought about this a lot, and then I read your proposal for this course, and I thought, oh, yeah, I would not have thought to put this particular, these European thinkers in conversation with this particular moment, but it seems obvious. Like, it's one of those great ideas that it now seems obvious once you read it, that these two should talk. I wonder how you teach at Sacramento State, a public university there. You're a philosopher by training and by trade. How did students respond to this? Did they see the Bible as kind of like a weird, mysterious oracle that has no reasoning to it? Or were they open to the idea that the biblical authors might be doing some form of political philosophy?
I think most of them had no idea one way or the other.
Okay.
I mean, there was a lot of like prep right at the beginning of the course where, we're going to do our level best to read this text as you would any of the other assigned texts in the course. Now, of course, they most of them had a background in political philosophy, and so they would have known a little bit at least about the social contract tradition. And framing it the way I did sort of gave them a way in. And of course, they know one of the things that they knew is that one really big problem with the social contract tradition is that they didn't so much care whether or not there was, and in fact very often knew that there wasn't any actual history of an agreement. Right.
Right.
So one kind of problem in the early modern social contract tradition is the problem David Hume laid out. Look, this never really happened. You know, all we have in history are like just mere claims of authority and that are backed up by conquest and power. And so that leaves a big opening for people to contest the obligatoriness of any putative social contract. One thing that's really interesting about the Hebrew narrative is that it's grounded in an historical narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that they sort of appreciated that point. I think it gave them a better feel for ways in which the social contract tradition can be problematic.
Yeah.
Just by being presented the comparison.
I think also the I don't know if it's Rousseau's account, but I have stuck in my mind the two savage men that meet in the woods and agree that they could kill each other, and so they agree to peace only.
Yeah.
These kind of origins stories of anonymous savages.
That's actually another interesting difference, right, between these two accounts, because in the thing that precedes the social contract in the early modern account is a state of nature where there aren't any rules. It's blameless liberty in all things. Yeah, even killing somebody you run across. But that's of course not true in the Hebrew narrative. There's a whole series of covenants that lead up to this one at Sinai. I guess the one I'm thinking of that actually establishes some kind of obligations prior to this one is the one with Noah, where God just says, "I'm going to demand an accounting for spilt blood," and it's a sort of setting up, establishing certain kinds of harm-based rules. The interesting thing about that one is that God didn't really ask for or require Noah's consent. It wasn't a covenant like made with a particular people. It was just a claim. God says, "I'm going to demand an accounting for these certain sort of basic harm-based violations of these rules." And the obligations are therefore like much more general, much more basic, much less specific to a certain people.
Right.
But you might also think that, you know, also common sense, maybe that's the kind of those kinds of rules, maybe you don't need an agreement to establish. They're so basic. They're just like, just natural reason dictates that you shouldn't go around spilling people's blood and so on.
Right. And especially the direct connection between blood and life there. And of course, blood in the Cain and Abel narrative, the dirt and blood mix. There's a string of history to that moment, even in the biblical narrative. I wonder also with, you know, thinking of a social contract theory, the thing that seems to be, as far as I know, entirely absent from it that you have at Sinai is God's love for his people and his love for all the families of the earth through which he'll show through this one particular people. And so it's not that God, you know, was flipping a roller decks and stopped at the Hebrews. It's that he actually loved these people and had this, all the terms are of father or, relatives or some kind of filial connection to them. I wonder if that is necessary or just a nice little addition.
Well, it certainly explains your earlier point about just how bad they were at keeping the covenant. You get, multiple chances because of this chosenness, because of this commitment on God's part to their good. I'm not sure if that was where we were heading towards, but I mean, this idea of sticking to these people come what may, and even in the Christian tradition, even on pains of God's own death, that puts a much different flavor to the social contract tradition.
And again, maybe you could give us a thumbnail, like social contract. What's the simple caricature of this that would be useful for us here?
Yeah. So it's, I mean, in the social contract tradition, they're just relying on this story about the moral magic of consent. When I consent or agree to do something, I can turn something that was wrong to do into something that's permissible to do, I guess, like a kiss, or I can turn something that was, I had a prerogative with respect to, into something that's an obligation, by promising to do it, like meeting with you instead of listening to Mastodon. So
I take it you're a Mastodon fan.
Okay.
I'm hearing that.
It's just an example. Anyway. So this moral magic that we have the power to do, and we do it just how magicians in mythical life do magic. We do it by saying the magic words, and the magic words are, I consent, or I agree, or I promise. But the problem with the and so they say, right, that when they say that there's a social contract, you would expect them to be able to produce the goods, like to show what the contract, where it is, what the terms are, when in history it happened. And that's when they start to sort of hedge. Well, we don't mean that you have to agree explicitly. Maybe we can agree tacitly. There's a kind of implied consent that we can make sense of in our ordinary lives. I mean, not every interaction where I'm relying on agreement in my daily life is one where I actually express the magic words. If I go up to a hamburger stand and order a hamburger, it's sort of implied that I'm agreeing to pay for it. When they bring me the hamburger and expect me to pay, I don't say something like, "What do you mean? I just wanted a cheeseburger. I didn't say I would pay for it." No, that wouldn't work, because we know that sometimes consent is tacit and implied.
And it would be too cumbersome to be otherwise.
That's right. Yeah. Now, of course, an explicit statement of dissent does usually trump any implied consent that somebody might expect. So if I went up to the hamburger stand and said, "Look, I really like a cheeseburger, but I'm not able to pay, and I will not pay." If they bring me the cheeseburger, I don't think that they can express any kind of outrage if I then don't pay.
Right.
So if explicit dissent trumps implied consent, then a social contract isn't going to establish political authority for everyone, because some people aren't going to sign. And they're going to say, despite your claims on me, despite what you think is allowing you to infer my consent, maybe because I continue to live here, or because you provide certain kind of social benefits, I'm saying hereby I dissent from your claims of authority. And again, if the agreement is what does the important work in establishing authority, that should be a sufficient for getting out from under the agreement. So the next move in most social contract theories is to say, well, if we don't have even implied consent, then they go for a model of hypothetical consent. And I guess the idea behind hypothetical consent is the idea that, you know, it's such a good deal that of course you would consent, or you would if you are a reasonable person, right? So I have like a bag of crappy used set of golf clubs in my basement. Maybe they're worth $70. just because it would be irrational in some sense, I guess, for me to not agree to a deal for someone to pay me, let's say, $500 for these crappy set of clubs. Doesn't mean that you can just come in and take them and leave $500, right? Hypothetical consent is not consent at all.
So let me, because that reminds me of what happens after Sinai, or I guess at Sinai. You do have a group of at least 3,000 or more, if you're reading Paul on it, who seem to dissent from the story that Yahweh is the sole one who brought them out of Egypt. And they create, you know, this golden calf, and they bow down and worship, and they have an orgy to it. And in my mind, I think they have all these reasons not to do any of this. So why would they do this? So we almost, you know, indict them because hypothetically they have all these reasons that should directly go against them. Is that a parallel situation, or am I twisting?
I guess I don't think so. I think, so I'll return to a, like maybe a harder case, but those people seem to me just like people who had agreed and then just violated the terms.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Now it might be a harder case would be subsequent generations that weren't party to the original covenant, right? Of course, people can bind themselves by their own agreement, but the obligations therein don't generally travel to people who weren't around, and they only arrive on the scene something like 200 years later or whatever, or any number of years later. So I think that's a harder case. And I guess one of the ways I see the Hebrew narrative dealing with it is these subsequent covenant renewal ceremonies,
right,
where they just do it again. Whenever there is like a new leader that came on the scene, or at some interval of number of years, usually corresponding with a generation, they have like a big, I don't know, powwow, where they
covenant.
Joshua Shechem is a good example of this. But there are many, many other instances of this where it seems like they were attuned to the problem of catching out people who came along later. I don't know if any people like at that time said, no, we're good, and maybe they, as a result, would have to leave or something like that. They'd have to separate themselves from the community. I think in general, it seems to me when I read the Hebrew narratives that, you know, exit conditions are not well provided for in the covenant. And so this isn't like there might be a problem for agreements that don't provide any kind of exit clause, but that's different than whether or not they at least attempted to, and of course they attempted to get people's agreement by just properly fetching them up in the traditions. They were raised in a community. They were taught things just like we teach our children things. They had psalms where they talked about loving the law. It wasn't just like some thing that was imposed from without that restricts. It's something that helps identify them, provides them an identity, and something that they, love. It sort of captures their affections.
Yeah, I was going to say, if You know, if you read the whole of the Torah as instruction on how to be the right kind of people, you know, the imagination that's being fired up there is that you really wouldn't want to live anywhere else. This is probably the singular place on the earth where justice can be maintained, equality can be maintained, where you can be protected as a vulnerable person, whether you're a foreigner or native born. So there's a sense, again, where it's a hypothetical, why would anybody want to leave?
Right.
But it is kind of a Hotel California situation, though, right? Like, as far as we know, you can check in whenever you want, but you can never leave, right?
That's right.
Yeah, I do wonder also, because I'm reading this book right now on Bedouin culture in the Bible, and a guy who's an anthropologist who lived with Bedouins for, you know, decades and has seen how lots of their behaviors have traversed thousands of years to explain things going on in Scripture. And I wouldn't call it a collectivist mindset, but more of a generationalist mindset that, you know, we hear the phrase third and fourth generation. Of course, as Americans, we think that that's a linear, my generation, then I die, then the next generation. But that likely refers to all the people living in one household at the same time. So that great grandparents all the way down to children are to the third and the fourth generation. But that you're always thinking generational. I mean, the worst thing that can happen to you as a Hebrew is to die without children, and thus your line and all the generations that would issue from you are cut off from the face of the land and the living. And so, but that doesn't stop in the Hebrew Bible either. I mean, I think of Acts 2 at Pentecost, you know, when they say, brothers, what shall we do? They say, be baptized, each one of you, for the repentance of your sins, you and your children and all, you know, and there's another like, consent situation there, right? For you at least, but then your children, maybe less consent, and all who God is going to call. So there's this kind of similar type of thinking that seems to pervade, I guess, that consent of the Father is consent of the Son in some way.
Yeah. At least you would expect, I mean, if you can't, so the problem of children and people fetched up within any kind of tradition is maybe always going to be a problem for any sort of liberal-minded view. But I don't think that there's like a significant tension here, just because everybody, you can't help but be subject to your raising. You can't help but be subject to certain kinds of influences that made an imprint on you as a young person. You are the person you are in part because of the people, because of where and when you were raised and the people who raised you. I think some people worry about consent being manufactured, but I don't know if there's a good way to distinguish between I'll put it the other way. I think that there must be a good way to distinguish between consent that's manufactured in a kind of illicit way through sort of some kind of impermissible manipulation, versus just the ordinary thing where people are taught certain things. And of course, if parents or like in a more larger sort of social level, if you are brought up, you know, according to the plan, I mean, I have children that, you know, that I'm super happy that they've made decisions that they've made about their relationship with Jesus. Of course, if I recognize that I had at least some role in that, but I don't think that I did something that's anything like a kind of impermissible brainwashing. Consent is funny in that what you'll find attractive enough to consent to is going to have like a history attached to it.
Right. And like
I don't
you
think
said,
that I don't think that's a bad thing.
Yeah, the traditioning of our children.
Right.
You know, that forms and shapes them intellectually and otherwise, and their practices and habits, you know, 90% of that is done before they're even at a place where they can give any real libertarian consent, right?
That's right.
So, it's like my kids didn't choose what perspective of chemistry we taught them either, or what perspective of physics.
Exactly.
You know, we just started explaining the world to them the way we best understood it. So,
yeah, the way we see it. And so in the Hebrew narratives, you get in Deuteronomy, you know,
right.
Lots
right.
about, like, you know, the obligation of parents to provide regular covenant instruction to their children. That's part of the account. That's part of the story. It's part of the thing that prepares them for their place in the community.
Maybe I can ask this.
Okay.
Why in a class on the idea of consent and liberal democracy did you go to the Hebrew Bible? Why not go to the Enuma Elish or the Mari documents or Egyptian texts or what most philosophy professors would do in your position, go straight to Greco-Roman text?
Now, I've taught that course before, or at least one of them, or maybe two of them, where it's sort of a very sort of stock and trade kind of course mm-hmm. in political philosophy to look at like early modern liberalism and its critics, and you might look at like pre-modern critics of what we take now to be the foundations of liberal democracy. Again, I've taught versions of this course. I was just approaching this as a different version of that same course. Why did I pick it? I mainly because I know a little bit more about it than I do the, you know, pre-modern Egyptians.
Right.
And I'm
it would have been and, more work.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. And mainly because I'm interested in this idea. I guess you would see it in like in moral philosophy, you would see it in terms of like a divine command theory of ethics.
Right.
I'm just interested in this idea of how relationships of authority are established and whether or not we need to assume that the right answer to that question is completely different when we're talking about a divine being, right?
Mm. Yeah, having read a little bit around in the Egyptian text and the Mesopotamian text, I do wonder if it would be nearly as easy to find any parallels to work with. Not that there wouldn't be anything, but that it wouldn't be so ripe and ready as the text of Sinai and beyond. So I wonder if there's more to it than, I think there is some natural affinity between what the Hebrew Bible is doing here and the way we've come to think about these things.
Yeah, I guess that's another way of answering your question. I would have thought that, I think a natural thing to think that is that it'd be very difficult to find and establish any kind of similarities in any pre-modern worldview. Mm. My interest in focusing on the Hebrew account was just how much of a surprise there is to find in a pre-modern account.
Right.
Even a sort of bare kind of connection.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Kyle Swan, thank you very much for your time and opening up this whole world of consent and liberal democracy to probably many of our listeners for the first time. We appreciate your time, and I'm really glad you got to run this course at Sacramento State.
Thank you, Drew.
You've been listening to the Biblical Mind podcast, exploring the deep structures of Christian scripture. For more, visit the magazine at thebiblicalmind.org. Subscribe to this podcast at all the usual places so you never miss an episode.